Unseen Diversity, Lecture 8. An Enormous and Diverse Group, the Gram Positives.
In this lecture, we're going to look at the Gram-positive bacteria, another enormous, diverse group of bacteria. But let me help you to recall from a previous lecture their interesting history. This was a group of bacteria discovered inadvertently by Dr. Hans Christian Gram, the Danish physician, who really did not have in mind looking at bacteria in this way at all, was just trying to use various stains for the purpose of making bacteria more visible against diseased tissue. And at that time, as you recall, the German dye industry was just getting going as an important source of new synthetic dyes, and all sorts of new synthetic dyes were being tried out on bacteria. And Dr. Hans Christian Gram just happened to try out one particular one that ended up being named after him. It's called the Gram stain. And it turns out that all bacteria, although not archaea, but all bacteria can be divided into two enormous groups, the Gram-positives, the ones that take up the stain and from which you cannot remove the stain, and the Gram-negatives, the ones that you could put the stain on, but once you try to remove the stain, you will end up removing the stain from them. They do not hold on to the stain. By the way, this is a bluish, purplish-colored stain, and when we do this in a microbiology lab, we typically then apply another stain afterwards to make the Gram-negatives show up too, and that's a pink stain. So if you have a combination of Gram-positive and Gram-negative bacteria together on a slide, you have typically a combination of blue-purple bacteria and pink bacteria, the blue-purples being the Gram-positives, and the pinks with some other stain just to make them show up are the Gram-negatives. So to everyone's surprise, that is still a good taxonomic group. Remember that I told you that the proteobacteria experienced a huge shakeup in their taxonomy such that everyone just gave up and named them after the first letters of the Greek alphabet, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon, and said, well, that's that. No more fancy names for these. Gram-positives still remain, even after all that DNA sequencing, a pretty good cohesive group divided into two subgroups. One of the things that makes them especially cohesive and probably a good evolutionary group in their own big branch of the family tree is that they have a different sort of cell wall, and actually it's that cell wall that makes them stain as they do. Another interesting thing about the Gram-positives is that many of them are spore formers. That is, they can make a little round, hard structure, very, very resistant to drying and very resistant to other sorts of environmental challenges, and even in some cases resistant to boiling. They are among the few bacteria that are not hyperthermophiles to begin with, among the few bacteria that can live at room temperature and yet could be taken to a boiling point and would survive that as long as they were tucked up inside of their little resistant spores. So Gram-positive, some of them can do that, and it's quite remarkable. Now, the two major groups of Gram-positives are the Firmicutes and the Actinobacteria. Firmicutes means firm skin, and that actually refers to their tough little cell walls, their cell walls that allow them to be stained in that particular way. And actinobacteria means thread bacteria. Now, I'm not usually giving you a lot of technical jargon because it's not necessary to remember it and to have that in order to appreciate the bacteria. But I did want to mention these two particular names because the thread-like nature of the actinobacteria is part of their lifestyle and is part of what's interesting about them. So I wanted to mention them. Another way to talk about the actinobacteria, in case you want to look them up later, is they have also been called the actinomycetes, actinomycetes. So they can be looked up under either name, actinobacteria or actinomycetes. Now, who are they, and what are the more accessible field marks? Well, it turns out that This is my opportunity to talk about our own personal natural bacteria of our bodies, our own personal microbiota. And it's also an opportunity for me to talk about the bacteria that make food and drink so interesting by their normal fermentative reactions. And it's also an opportunity for me to connect those two together because they are very much connected. Our personal bacteria, completely normal bacteria, are also one and the same in many, many cases as the bacteria that are enhancing food and drink through fermentative processes. So it's a chance to show off some really fun field marks of both of those. And then in a subsequent lecture, I'm going to say something about the gram positives that live in the soil. So beginning with our own natural bacteria, and I keep repeating the word natural and normal because I want to really distinguish these from the pathogens, which are few and far between and which will have their own lecture in its place. And this is maybe the beginning of the setup for that lecture because I want to make sure that we start with the normal bacteria so that we can really contrast them when we get to the pathogens. We have a huge number of bacteria and we know relatively little about what they're all doing. What we can say with a certain amount of confidence is that they're not pathogenic. They're doing something benign, that is nothing particularly positive or negative, perhaps, but beneficial is very likely the case for many of them, and we're still sorting out a lot of their beneficial activities. I'm going to suggest a few of them and tell you a little bit about what research is telling us about them, but this is still very much an open question as to what all of them are doing. There are so many of them. And it's such a normal part of who we are. How normal is it? Well, from the point of view of bacteria, we are essentially a culture chamber for them, loaded with nutrients from top to bottom. I mean, our entire digestive system from our mouth to our anus is just one enormous bacterial community. And then the outside surface, our skin, is also another wonderful diverse community for bacteria, ranging all the way from moist areas, such as in the groin or the armpit, or areas that are typically covered by clothing, especially in a temperate climate, to areas that are relatively dry and have relatively few bacteria. Bacteria are moisture lovers. So there's a wide range of what can happen on the skin, but the combination of all of the bacteria of our skin and all of the bacteria that are inside of our digestive system makes up about 10% of our body weight, 10%. But it makes up about 90% of our cells, 90%. And let's digest those two numbers for just a moment because they seem maybe a little contradictory. How could all of our combined bacteria be only 10% of our body weight and yet make up 90% of our cells? And that gives us a little view of just how tiny bacterial cells are. And maybe this is a good point for me to sort that out just a little bit. This is a point at which it might be useful for me to stop and tell you that there are two major sizes and complexities of cells. There are the tiny, relatively simple cells of archaea and bacteria, and about which we've been talking for most of this course. And there are the larger, more complex cells of protists, fungi, plants, and animals. These are the larger, more complex cells that arose later than the bacteria and which then gave rise to all the other microorganisms that are not bacteria and archaea, as well as all of the multicellular organisms, many of the fungi, the animals, and the plants. One way to think about this is all bacteria and archaea are microorganisms, but not all microorganisms are bacteria and archaea. There are plenty of microorganisms of the protists and of the fungi that are these larger complex cells. And by larger, I still mean microscopic, but these larger complex cells. And this goes a little way toward explaining how this seeming contradiction could be that we have 10% body weight of bacteria, but they are 90% of our cells. Their cells are much, much tinier. So we can pack an awful lot of cells into that 10% body weight. There are 10 to the 13th cells that we can claim as our own, 10 to the 13th approximately human cells per human body. Of course, that depends on the size of the human, and these cells are not that easy to enumerate, but in the order of 10 to the 13th, there are 10 to the 14th bacteria that we're carrying around with us. That's 90% of our cells are bacteria. Some scientists have even suggested that we are more like a microbial community with an attached human body than a human body that has microbes, that maybe the whole thing should be reversed around, that really we are first and foremost a microbial community with all sorts of interesting crevices and places for bacteria to be. Let me give you one example from our skin before we go into the digestive system to try to figure out what some of those bacteria are doing in there, which is where the majority of our bacteria are. If you take this skin of your armpit, and perhaps if you haven't been using any personal products for a few days, and that would be the ideal situation if you were looking for bacteria, and if you took a square centimeter of that armpit material, you would find 2.5 million bacteria enjoying themselves there on the moisture and in the secretions that are in that area. And I'm also going to say they're not pathogens. It could be that there's an aesthetic issue there. It could be that there are some reasons to keep those folks under control. But these are not pathogens. They're part of your normal body bacteria. You could take any animal and look for the moistest part of its body and find that sort of numbers of bacteria in that area. So it's a perfectly normal situation in moist areas of any organism's body. Okay, so what are these bacteria doing? We don't know what they're all doing. And in fact, there's a brand new genome initiative that has just been begun to take stock of the potentially thousands of species of bacteria that are in and on us and to understand them much better, especially from the point of view of what they have in their DNA sequences, to find out what they're doing. Many of them may be benign, neither positive or negative in their relationship with us. Many, many more may be beneficial, and there's still much to be sorted out. It's interesting that this particular genome initiative is commencing at a time when there is heightened hysteria about pathogenic bacteria and almost a different force of activities around keeping ourselves scrubbed clean of bacteria and keeping our surfaces that we associate with as sterile as possible of bacteria. It's a bit ironic because I think, and I have to say personally, I hope that what will ultimately win out in this is a general understanding of bacteria that is much more in the direction of their beneficial aspects or benign aspects and above all their normal aspects in their relationship with us. I would even go so far as to say that pathogenicity is a bit of an illusion. Certainly there are some serious pathogens, and I'm going to tell you about them in a lecture coming up, but many of them have many bacteria that are now being called pathogens have been quietly moved into that category by industries who are eager to sell us antibacterial items. Okay, so I'll leave you with that thought and let me go on to our own personal bacteria and tell you a little bit about what we think they might be doing. First thing they might be doing is taking up space. They certainly do take up space. 90% of our cells, they're certainly taking up some space. But that might be extremely important because that space that is not being taken up by whatever pathogens there might be. In other words, if you've got a full intestinal tract full of your bacteria, then you don't have a whole lot of place for anything else to settle down. And you actually have some firsthand experience with that. You've probably done a sort of an experiment yourself on this that I will tell you about in just a few moments. Second thing that they might be doing, and this is some new research that is very exciting, and which is very much ongoing and about which there are new developments all the time, is that our bacteria may keep our immune systems ready and on the alert. revving them up, as it were, so that if we do encounter a true pathogen, and there are true pathogens, if we do encounter a true pathogen, our immune system is ready to go and ready to go into action. And that our normal bacteria, which begin to colonize our bodies at birth, we're born essentially sterile of bacteria, but our normal bacteria, which begin to colonize us at birth, are going hand in hand with the development of our immune systems when we're born. A baby's immune system has to develop, and a child's immune system is still developing, and the bacteria that that baby or child is carrying, the normal bacteria, may be helping that whole process. And in fact, impeding that process, keeping a child or a baby in too sterile an environment, keeping that baby or child away from other babies and children, being overly paranoid about the bacteria in the world of that baby or child may actually be more of a hindrance to the correct development of the immune system. So that's some exciting new research in two things that our bacteria may be doing for us in a very beneficial way. Here's a little of the evidence for that. There have been some interesting epidemiological studies comparing and contrasting humans from either parts of the country or from different countries that are more rural and more likely a place where children would be encountering animals or children would be encountering normal soils and maybe even getting involved with agriculture of some sort, maybe living in larger families, having more interactions with a variety of people, versus perhaps more urban families, perhaps more affluent families that have no pets. The children have few siblings, children are apt to have their own rooms, and perhaps the parents are especially vigilant about soil and bacteria in the house. And you compare and contrast those two groups, and you find much more of asthma and allergies in the kids that have been kept away from just a normal interaction with bacteria. Bacteria of the soil, bacteria of other children, the normal household bacteria that you would expect to find. And one hypothesis about that is that their immune systems are acting inappropriately. Essentially, asthma and allergies can be simplified, and this is going to be too much of a simplification, so forgive me for that, but I'll do it in just a couple of sentences. Asthma and allergies really can be chalked up to immune systems that are acting inappropriately. Why would an immune system cause you to react to strawberries? It sounds crazy. It is crazy. There's an immune system that's going a bit haywire if it doesn't allow you to eat strawberries, or it doesn't allow you to eat wheat, or it doesn't allow you to drink milk, or it doesn't allow you to have shellfish. Why? I mean, why would our immune system be vigilant against those particular foods? So that's an immune system that's gone awry. What's wrong with breathing in a little bit of plant pollen? Why would folks get allergies to plant pollen? Why would people have breathing problems under some circumstances, as you get with asthma and allergies? So these are what seem to be developing in communities in which things are overly sterile and which infants and children are being kept artificially away from others and maybe not getting a proper influx of bacteria into their lives. Here's some other things that our personal bacteria are doing. They seem to be producing vitamin B12 and vitamin K and perhaps even other vitamins for us. We are an enormous resource of nutrients for them, but they, in contrast, seem to be supplementing our nutrients with these essential vitamins. Experiments have been done with rodents in which they have been taken at birth from their mothers and not allowed to develop a repertoire of microbes in their digestive systems, to take a look and see what happens to the production of these vitamins. And essentially, these vitamins don't get produced in those rodents, and they suffer for a number of reasons for not having their full microbial community. So what are the field marks for these? Well, odors of all sorts, because remember, bacteria are all about what they do. And what they do is they take up things from the environment and they release things into the environment. And much of what they release is in the form of odors. So I will say that you already have been experimenting all your life with bacterial odors. You certainly know something about what we do with skin care to prevent odors in various places. As far as your bacteria in your digestive system, I will contend that you've been experimenting with those all your life. You know from personal experience that extra fiber in foods, that legumes such as beans, that extra flavorful foods such as garlic and onions and coffee and chocolate can do all sorts of interesting things to natural body odors. I'll give you a particular example. Many of our most flavorful foods have tiny amounts of sulfur in them. Just the right amount of sulfur makes something delicious. So garlic and onions have just the right amount of sulfur to make them savory and delicious. Well, in your digestive system are bacteria that grab onto that sulfur and produce a wonderful smelly gas called hydrogen sulfide, which has this very sharp smell of sulfur, and which is a great example of the kind of output that your bacteria can produce that would then be chalked up to your body odor. In fact, it's the bacterial odor that you're smelling. Second experiment that I suspect many people have done, whether they wanted to or not, is that you've been prescribed a course of antibiotics by your doctor for something serious, and the type of antibiotic you were given wiped out many of your normal bacteria from your intestines, and therefore allowed an influx at a particular point of inappropriate bacteria or inappropriate balances of bacteria, and you experienced from that antibiotic, therefore, extreme intestinal pain. I know I've had this happen to me, and I suspect it's happened in some other to some of you with courses of antibiotics. So there's a little glimpse of what it's like to live without your bacteria. And the third thing I think you've tried a little bit in an experimental way is prebiotics and probiotics. Those are some new words that I think are coming into common parlance and which I think are going to be very useful in years to come. A prebiotic is any food that you take deliberately into your system for the purpose of enhancing and helping your normal bacteria. A really good example of a prebiotic is a nice bowl of oatmeal. Nothing your bacteria like better than a nice fibrous bowl of oatmeal. And so in a sense, you're revving up your bacterial system by having oatmeal. And that would be one thing to try to do if you were suffering from the effects of antibiotics and if your bacteria were suffering from the effects of antibiotics. Another thing that you could consider is probiotics, and that term is being currently used for directly taking in bacteria that will be useful to your system. And one great example is with yogurts. But it's not the only example by any means, but yogurts are a wonderful example. And more these days, the yogurt manufacturers are recognizing this about their product and are proudly listing on the side of the container all the different bacteria that are inside. It's getting to be a longer and longer list, I notice, over the years as this becomes more and more a positive attribute of yogurt. And certainly, one of the things that your doctor may have advised you to do if you are taking a course of antibiotics is to, at the same time, have plenty of yogurt to try to reconstitute your normal good bacteria in your digestive system. In fact, some doctors even go so far nowadays to suggest that you go to the part of the drugstore or the part of the pharmacy where probiotic pills can be bought. And these are little freeze-dried cultures of bacteria, similar to the bacteria that you would find in yogurt. So you could get really the same bacteria if you were just eating yogurt or eating other fermented milk products. But that would be one place to reconstitute your bacteria quickly if you were trying to counteract the effects of antibiotics. So this is, I think, a really positive trend in medicine and a really good way to look at bacteria. And it certainly does not preclude the need for antibiotics, and it certainly does not would not cause anyone to make light of true pathogens, but I think it is important to put pathogens into their real place in the context of all these thousands of bacteria that are normal. Now, from the point of view of your bacteria, your body and your food are on a continuum. Okay, not from our point of view, but certainly from their point of view, that the food that you take in, and the food that goes out the other end and the food that gets cycled around through the environment and goes back in again, it's all part of one continuum, and they are part of that. So that a way to think about the evolution of all the wonderful fermented foods in the world, all the wines and the beers and the sourdough breads and the various pickles and the kimchis and fermented fish and fermented soybeans and the marvelous cheeses and everything that makes cuisine worth enjoying, all of those fermented foods are really not so much an invention of our human ancestors as it is something that they tolerated and then came very quickly to enjoy. Because from the point of view of a bacterium, they're on your body, therefore they're in your kitchen, therefore they're in that pail of milk that you just brought in from milking the cow, and therefore they're in the milk fermenting overnight, and then they are in a few days part of what is going to become cheese. Fermenting milk, essentially milk that's starting to go bad, milk that's starting to decay, is milk that's on its way to being cheese. One of the surprising things that was surprising to me when I first learned it is the bacteria from your body that are most likely to be among your beneficial bacteria and the most likely to take up housekeeping in a pail of milk or a container of soybeans, or grains, or grapes, or vegetables, or fish, are gram-positives. Okay, I don't know exactly why that is. I just know that's the case, that we are full of beneficial and benign gram-positives, and so are our fermented foods. And if you're thinking to yourself, well, why aren't other bacteria, including pathogens, tumbling into that same pail of milk? Why is it that we're getting cheese out the other end? Why aren't we getting something toxic and nasty to eat instead of a wonderful new cheese? I think it's that the gram-positives not only tumble in, but immediately set up whatever metabolism that they're going to do and start to exclude other bacteria. It's why fermented foods are not just delicious, they're a great way to preserve food too. And believe me, our ancestors understood that and knew that, that a great way to preserve something fresh for the winter was to allow it to naturally ferment so that pretty much every available nutrient was being used by gram-positive bacteria to the exclusion of any other bacteria. So even though making a fermented food is sometimes set up to be something pretty complicated, you need to follow a recipe, you need to have particular cultures of bacteria in order to get a particular cheese, I would contend that it's actually simpler than you might think. It's just your normal body bacteria. It's just your normal bacteria around the kitchen that are the most likely to be able to make the fermented products that I'm talking about. By the way, this is a good point for me to give some credit to the fungi. They deserve a great deal of credit. Along with the bacteria on your body, you also have fungi, usually in the form of yeast. And that's very convenient because yeast are the wonderful fermenting microorganisms that participate with bacteria to also give us all the wonderful fermented foods and drinks of the world. And this is another point for me to reiterate that there are plenty of fungi among the microbes. They are in their own group. So again, fungi can be microorganisms. Bacteria and archaea are very definitely microorganisms. And microorganism is the overall umbrella name for anything that's really tiny. And there's a diversity of organisms under that rubric. So some people might recall the word shibboleth from the Old Testament. It was a word that some Israeli tribes could pronounce and some could not. And shibboleth came to be a metaphor for talking about that which was defining of a culture such that you could tell that another person was of a different culture if they were unable to pronounce your words. And I would argue that microbial fermentations, I'm including the fungi there too, microbial fermentations are important definers of culture because food can be a real shibboleth. No matter how much you might enjoy fresh foods and fresh meats and other fresh things, as soon as that fermentation starts, you're starting to head into the direction of really distinctive cuisines, such that if you've grown up with a particular sort of fermented fish, or you've grown up with a particular sort of fermented soybean or fermented milk, which is cheese and other sorts of products, that might be your favorite food. That might be your comfort food. That might be the food that defines your culture and your holidays, the food you long for, the food that you want to go home for. And it may be the most challenging of food to eat as an adult if you're trying to be polite in another person's culture. I mean, the real challenge of anthropologists and world travelers may be not so much eating the fresh foods of another culture, but the shibboleth foods, the foods that are part of the continuum of that culture from body to food and back to body again. Okay, so let me name some names here. Who are some of these bacteria? Remember I said there are two major kinds of gram-positives. We have Firmicutes, and the three most important Firmicutes are Streptococcus, Staphylococcus, and Lactobacillus. When I say important, I mean in respect to what we might be able to isolate easily from our body amongst our normal body bacteria. And I really wanted to name those names because of all the bacterial names that are commonly used, Streptococcus, nicknamed Strep, as in strep throat, and Staphylococcus, nicknamed Staph, as in staph infection, are ones that people have heard of. Strep and staph, and not necessarily in a positive context either. So I need to explain that because I'm describing them as best I can in a positive context. And Lactobacillus, that was the third that I mentioned. And for that matter, any bacterium that has a lacto prefix. So it could be Lactobacillus, Lactococcus, anything with a lacto prefix to it is indicative of body bacteria that can participate in fermenting milk products, making yogurt, making various sorts of cheeses. But let me get back to Streptococcus and Staphylococcus, the other two Firmicutes of our body that are fairly common. We keep them in check. We have immune systems. We have relatively dry skin. We have skin that does not typically have deep, deep cuts and wounds. If we do, then there are problems. But for the most part, we are well defended. So there are categories of bacteria that are considered to be opportunistic. Under some circumstances, they may become problems, but those are far and few between the absolutely normal system of having them always with us, in us, and on us. Streptococcus and Staphylococcus are actually a wonderful example. If your immune system is functioning, if you don't have deep cuts, say from surgeries or wounds or transplants or some kind of major hospital procedure, you're keeping them in check and they're part of your normal microbiota. It's an important point, and it's a point I'll come back to later when we talk about pathogens. There's been a sort of creeping definition of what a pathogen is, and I will agree that a Streptococcus or Staphylococcus out of place doing the wrong things in a patient who's maybe compromised in some way from surgery or from immunosuppressant drugs is maybe in some trouble. But for the most part, these are bacteria that we could easily isolate from anyone's skin. So you're carrying these all the time, and yet you are in a normal and healthy situation with them. Of the actinobacteria, that's the other group of gram-positives, we have a couple that are especially interesting. We have Propionibacterium and Brevibacterium, and the two of them contribute to some of our most intriguing body odors. Propionibacterium usually begin to proliferate during puberty when our glands start to produce sweat, including some varieties of sweat that have some interesting odors. And these particular bacteria immediately start to culture themselves or to reproduce themselves in those areas that become sweaty, especially around puberty, and give off some of the normal body odors that are associated with puberty and then adulthood. So hold on to that thought for a second, because that's not the only thing that they're doing. And then Brevibacterium. Those are among the bacteria that are enjoying the dark, moist spaces between your toes, especially if you've got shoes. And not all cultures have always had shoes on their feet, but we certainly are a shoe-wearing culture here in the United States. So shoe wearers, especially, can harbor Brevibacterium, and they are enjoying the moisture between the toes, along with a little bit of skin that just naturally flakes off. We're constantly renewing our skin and also giving off a little bit of the smell of foot odor. So now we've got two major kinds of bodily odors, and by the way, it's bacteria that are doing them. Guess what? Those same bacteria are in your kitchen. Those same bacteria fall into a pail of milk. Those same bacteria set up housekeeping in that milk and begin to ferment it to the exclusion of other bacteria. And that's how we get some of the major important cheeses of the world. Propionibacterium are what gives us the Swiss cheeses, the big whole cheeses with a wonderful nutty flavor, and the big holes, which are the big holes are because these bacteria get to fermenting so fast that they produce lots and lots of carbon dioxide, and those are big bubbles where carbon dioxide was being formed. So it's because of those skin bacteria of puberty that we have all of the Swiss cheeses. And the Brevibacterium is responsible for the surface washed category of cheeses, those cheeses that tend to have a pinkish to tannish scum on their outside, and which include Limburgers and Munster cheeses, real Munster cheeses, and other such smelly cheeses, which are real shibboleths. Either people grew up with these particular cheeses or have learned to like them, but for the most part, there's a real learning curve for an adult who's introduced for the first time to a Limburger cheese. Now, also point out that Munster cheese that you can get in a grocery store, in the ordinary dairy section of a grocery store, sometimes has a little bit of red dye painted around the edge to mimic the look of Brevibacterium, because the grocery store does not necessarily want to have this kind of cheese festering away in that particular section of the store. Where you look to find a real Munster or a real Limburger that still has active pinkish-colored Brevibacterium on its surface is at a real cheese shop, where the cheesemonger is presumably keeping it under control and monitoring the situation, lest it stink up the entire store, which it is capable of doing. And I'll remind you, Brevibacterium, that's your foot odor bacteria. And what they're doing is kind of interesting. Remember I said that sulfur in tiny quantities makes food delicious and savory and wonderful, and sulfur in large quantities makes food less delicious, maybe even nauseating, maybe even inedible. Brevibacterium specializes in chewing up proteins that have sulfur in them and releasing sulfurous compounds. And it's those sulfurous compounds in small amounts that make surface-ripened cheeses so delicious. So it's something that is very much in the category of a shibboleth. And I realize I'm doing really not much service to all of the wonderful Asian cuisines and Nordic cuisines that have turned their attentions to soybeans and fish of various sorts. But you could do that easily. In fact, there's no culture on earth that hasn't embraced some aspect of fermentation. It's just that no culture has embraced everyone else's aspects of fermentation. It becomes really a very personal thing. And I need to mention another group of bacteria here, because I don't want to leave you with the impression that our bodies and our food are all about gram positives. There's another enormous group of bacteria, the Bacteroides, that are gram negatives, that are their very own branch of the family tree, that are an enormous aspect of the population of the bacteria that we're carrying around, and about which we know relatively little. And the reason we know relatively little about them is because not a single one is genuinely pathogenic. And most research through the 20th century was to understand as best we could those that were pathogenic or potentially pathogenic. So it's more of this irony of our own misunderstanding, in some cases, of our own body bacteria. Here's this enormous group that we're only beginning to understand, the Bacteroides, and our lack of understanding is because there are no pathogens in this group. Another group of bacteria that we have besides the gram-positives that I really should mention in passing, and then I'll talk about a little bit further later, is E. coli, Escherichia coli. They're a normal part of our intestinal bacteria, but they are not an abundant part of our intestinal bacteria. And that's an important point. If you think of your intestinal bacteria as a balanced community of bacteria, balanced use in that metaphorical way that we sometimes use when we're talking about a tropical rainforest that's pristine in some way, or a temperate forest that seems to have, you know, the right numbers of animals and plants, if there is any such thing. We're using it in a metaphorical way. So in a balanced community, E. coli is in its place, and it is no more harmful than any other bacterium that you've got in there. In fact, it is making vitamin K for us. E. coli makes vitamin K. So it's not only not harmful, it's benign to beneficial. So you might be wondering, what's going on with E. coli scares? What's going on with what gets called a coliform count, which appears to be a count of E. coli, for example, in a public swimming pool where something has gone wrong, or a coliform count, presumably of E. coli in a water system where something has gone wrong, or where E. coli is implicated in traveler's diarrhea, a problem where if you drink water in a country other than your own, perhaps you're getting an E. coli infection. So I'm going to try to address that in a later lecture. But for now, I want to leave you with the thought of E. coli being, again, just as the gram-positives are, part of our normal microbiota when they're in their place and when they're in the right numbers. So in conclusion, that has been an introduction to the gram-positives of our body and of our food, but there's more to say about the gram-positives. And so the next lecture will be about the gram-positives that are in the soils of the world. And I will give you some suggestions about how you might get some firsthand understanding of those and maybe a better understanding of how soils work.
This ends Lecture 8.